The following lecture is brought to you by the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, FARMS, at Brigham Young University. It was delivered February 6th, 1977.
We are extremely fortunate tonight to have as our speaker Dr. Hugh Nibley, Professor Emeritus of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Dr. Nibley was graduated summa cum laude from the University of California at Los Angeles and completed a University Fellow PhD at the University of California at Berkeley in 1934. After serving in military intelligence in World War II, he taught at Claremont College in California before joining the Brigham Young University faculty in 1946. It should also be pointed out that Dr. Nibley served as a missionary for the LDS Church in several countries, Switzerland, Germany, and Greece. After joining the BYU faculty in 1946, he married the former Phyllis Draper, and they are the proud parents of 8 children and several grandchildren, I might add. A few years ago, Dr. Nibley was honored by the Brigham Young University as a recipient of the David O. McKay Humanities Award. In June of 1976, he retired from full-time teaching at BYU after 30 years of devoted teaching there. He now spends most of his time in research and writing, but still finds time to teach a few classes on the Y campus. Dr. Nibley is a legendary figure on the BYU campus. His skill in more than a dozen languages, including Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Egyptian, Aramaic, Coptic, Sanskrit, Arabic, Russian, French, and German have earned him, of course, a lot of admiration. In fact, you might wonder how he was able to learn all those languages, and I asked him this about 2 weeks ago when I went down to ask him to come up here and speak this evening, and he gave me a very intelligent answer. He said, exigency. When you have to learn them, you do. And, Dr. Nibley is also famous because of his research into ancient documents dealing with religious practices and lifestyles and the relationship to modern religion. Also, because of his vigorous defense of Mormon scriptures have earned him a worldwide reputation as a scholar. Hal Knight of the Deseret News, in a recent article in September 1st, 1976, had this to say about Dr. Nibley. Those who know Dr. Nibley best are apt to describe him as a real Renaissance man who is interested in and competent in nearly the whole landscape of human endeavor. Music, art, history, science are all fascinating to him. Theater has always fascinated him. He knows music and is an avid concert goer. He has read most of the world's great literature, including the foreign works in their native languages, and plays the piano quite adequately. He has a passion for everything. He could have been great in any field, according to his brother Reed Nibley. Dr. Knight goes on to say that Dr. Nibley is a tireless documenter. His thorough footnotes have been known to drive editors to distraction. Once he wrote a magazine article which consisted of a manuscript of 7 pages and 7 more pages of footnotes. One time, it was pointed out in the same article that Dr. Nibley left a note on his door saying that he had left and would not be back, and it turns out that he traveled to California to check out 1 footnote. So he's meticulous. He's careful. Everything he does is with great care. I might point out that I decided to look up how many footnotes he wrote in his series of articles on the Book of Enoch that is presently appearing in the LDS magazine, the Ensign, and I found to my amazement that there were 340 footnotes in less than 50 pages. This, of course, shows us how careful Dr. Nibley is in his research. Dr. Nibley has written countless articles, too numerous to know just exactly. Probably he doesn't know how many articles he's written in the many years that he's been writing. Many of his books are quite well known, including books such as Since Cumorah, The World and the Prophets, Lehi in the Desert and the World of the Jaredites, And, of course, his latest book, The Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, An Egyptian Endowment, which is can be found in Westminster College's library. It's written in Egyptian hieroglyphics, and, of course, Dr. Nibley translated it into English. Dr. Nibley is presently working on a book dealing with the Enoch material on the Book of Enoch. And so let me tell you that it gives me the greatest pleasure of my life to introduce to you the man I admire most in the world, the most brilliant man that I ever met, and the man who, the author of the most interesting works that I ever read, Dr. Hugh Nibley.
And if you want to go now, it'd be a good time to leave. What an introduction. Well, well, well. Now, the subject of our spiel is a stage without a play. I like these small, intimate groups, anyway. The world we live in today is a stage without a play. Now, this was brought home to me 30 years ago when, at the dawn of a cold March morning, I happened to approach the Third Mesa with Brother Virgil Bushman, a longtime missionary to the Hopis. When we stepped through the little tunnel into the windy plaza, it was still dark, and what I saw was most remarkable. To an audience consisting of only one or two ancients and a handful of shivering children, a full-scale Greek chorus of 52 dancers, elaborately and splendidly attired, was that early spring dance in March, his tremendous headdress and so forth. Nothing can be old or dirty. Everything's new. Nothing can be bought at the store. It all has to be the real stuff. What labor goes into that? But here they were performing a sort of play with the protagonists in it. And why were they going to all that trouble with nobody to look at it? I soon learned that this drama was part of a cycle that went through the year. We had come to the Mesa to visit Tom Kuyushva, 94 years old at that time, who was one of the grand old men of the Hopis and explained many things to us. These people were at that time enduring and since have endured what we would consider insufferable hardships, and that cheerfully, because they knew what they were doing. They had a plot to their play. They had a scenario to go by. What was most impressive was that this carefully staged theater was being performed in a vacuum. At that time, there was only a dirt road, that was a long time ago, leading to the Mesa, and it ran for 60 miles through a scene of utter desolation. Those were dry years in Tusayan, was at any time the driest of countries. There was nothing but sky and rock, and so that it seemed, as it really was, that we actually were beholding a drama in space, in bare space with nothing but sky and primordial earth between, in a rocky planet orbiting in a vast emptiness. To find an inhabited planet in space is remarkable enough, but to find a full-scale drama in progress when you stumble on it, you stumble on this planet out there in space with nothing on it that you can see, and here is a full-scale drama in progress. What's going on here? That's something truly fundamental. The whole strength and astounding survival of the Hopis lies in their plot, to their scenario by which they live. My point is that our world does not have such. The scenario was their real life. The vicissitudes of life were a parody, use the Greek word, means just a byplay, a sideshow, a mock play on the side, but that's the only play outsiders ever see. And our existence is a parody, it's not the real play. Scenario is a Hollywood word, we have to use it, it's a good one, we can define it here. We use it now in all sorts of plots and plans, as you know, and it's very old, it's a Renaissance word. But the dictionary defines it as an outline or synopsis of a play or the book of an opera showing the scenes and entrances and exits of the actors. An abstract of the chief incidents in any drama or work arranged according to act and scene, giving a sort of skeleton of the piece. That's your Godspell, that's your spiel, that's your play, that's what your show is going to be. And a model is a scenario, then you say, is a plausible story to explain a certain condition or situation. Whereas a model is a plausible mechanism to show how something works. That's a set, dictionary calls that, a set of plans or designs for a building to be erected, or similar drawings to scale for a structure already built, sometimes a ground plan, and so forth and so on. In general, models are scientific, scenarios are religious or philosophical. They go together. The properties of the play determine the play. The play is determined, are determined by the play, you might say, and they suggest the play. Of course, they don't determine it. See, all the scientist does is study the properties of the play. He doesn't study the plot. Find out what's going on. This is important. There are a number of scenarios available today, not just the Hopis. Every scenario is a model, and a model is as a model, and it has its merits and its faults. The best have survived for hundreds of years, and the weaker ones fall by the way, but all are tentative. Each one offers only a suggested solution. This was the gospel too. Try it on for size. Try it this way and see how it works. The best models are strong enough to dispense with dogmatic touchiness. The question is not which scenario explains everything perfectly, as we know them, none does, of course, but which gives you the best explanation of the most phenomena to your greatest satisfaction. You choose the model that suits you best. Now, what Joseph Smith gave the world was a remarkably full and complete scenario, an enormous structure, actually. And this accounts for a good deal of what happened when he started giving it to the world. Brigham Young shows us the reaction on both sides. He rushed as to a banquet spread by the prophet. He came like a starving man. Why? He tells us quite plainly. Because his world had no real explanation for anything, no satisfying scenario. It was not hard work or austere living that made life gloomy in Puritan New England, but the sense of not really knowing what it was about. This being beyond the scope, went beyond the scope of their disciplinary rules. As Samuel Sewall sat in church one morning, he writes in his famous journal, "The idea occurred to me with great force and conviction that Jesus Christ had never existed." And this from the most devout and conservative member of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So Brigham says, being raised in that atmosphere, there was more or less of a gloom over my feelings from the earliest days of my childhood that I have in my recollection, until I heard the everlasting gospel declared by the servants of God. The secret feeling of my heart was that I would be willing to crawl around the earth on my hands and knees to see such a man as was Peter, Jeremiah, Moses, or any man who could tell me anything about God and heaven. But to talk with the priest was no more satisfactory to me than it is now to talk with lawyers. And he says, when I saw Joseph Smith, he took heaven, figuratively speaking, and brought it down to earth, and he took earth and brought it up and opened up in plainness and simplicity the things of God. Under that preaching, the gloom vanished and has not since troubled me for a moment. I gave away all I had. I started to preach the gospel. I was obliged to do it, for I felt as though my bones would consume within me if I did not. Consequently, I devoted my time to preaching. So there you have it. As he says, outside of the religion we have embraced, there is nothing but death, hell, and the grave. My question is, do we have any competing theses to offer here? I have heard old-timers, pioneers, declare more than once. They would gladly, well, my grandparents, for example, gladly go through everything they did all over again, 1,000 times as necessary. Why? They hadn't seen Joseph Smith. They didn't know him. They joined the church in the old country and come over here. And it was for the gospel. Why always for the gospel, a mere doctrine, an abstraction? Because it told them what they yearned to know and nobody else could. There were times when they possessed nothing else, and then they felt themselves richest. That was enough. The reaction of the world around Joseph Smith clearly proclaims their bankruptcy. I think it's one of enraged frustration. Some years ago, surveying all the major anti-Mormon works from the beginning to the 1950s, I noted their standard stereotype reaction to Joseph's messenger. The trouble was not only that Joseph Smith was putting forth the most wildly extravagant story and doctrine that anyone had ever heard, but what was far worse, they had nothing whatever to put up against him. Hence the two paradoxes often noted in the history of the church, the fierce, unparalleled persecution of the Mormons for no apparent reason whatever, and on the other hand, the incredible loyalty of the Latter-day Saints to their cause, regardless of the hardships they had to face, or the difficulty of getting along with each other, or accepting some of their leaders. Even the apostates could never shake its influence once they'd come under it. The scenario was worth everything. For that, they were willing to sacrifice anything. Now, some of these objections point this out very clearly. You take E.D. Howe in his very famous work, the most famous anti-Mormon work written. He says here, after this, working like this, he recognizes the two terrible threats Joseph Smith presented. One, it has an overpowering appeal to many honest and intelligent people. And second, society has nothing to put up against it. This is what hurt, you see. He says at the beginning, that our task has been a laborious one, and we acknowledge, but little has been effective. We should have abandoned the task were it not that so many of our worthy citizens have been seduced by the witcheries and mysterious necromancies of Smith into folly and madness. Which brings us to the third point, that Joseph Smith's scenario was not, as is being commonly declared today, typical of its time and place, a perfectly normal product of the Burnt Over District and so forth. The reaction was always the same. People said, this is something outrageous, we don't know of anything like this, this is intolerable, we can't stand up, but this is inexcusable. So E.D. Howe continues here, in our review, we are left without weapons to combat the credulous Mormon believer. The only hope remaining is to reach and save any mind who has not inhaled the malaria of the impostor. That is, we must get to the public before Joseph Smith does, but once they hear it, they're dead ducks. We don't have anything to put up against it. William Harris says the same thing here. And like the early Christians, this message had a genuine shock effect. It was so different from anything anybody had heard. I have hundreds of references. They all deal with this thing. Like the ancient apostles, remember, who turned the world upside down was the accusation against him. Thomas Gregg, in his famous work, The Prophet of Palmyra, says that book is below the dignity of criticism. That such a book should find tens of thousands of persons of ordinary intelligence throughout Christendom who accept it as a revelation from God to man is indeed a moral phenomenon unparalleled in the 19th century. Many pages might be written filled with instances of the senseless, ridiculous, incongruous, and blasphemous character of the work. And another one says, no argument or mode of reasoning could induce anyone to believe that in the 19th century in the United States, in the blaze of science, literature, and civilization, a sect of religionists should arise on delusions and impositions. But such are the facts, and we are forced to believe them. Well, with science, literature, religion, and patriotism holding all the cards, it's indeed strange that they could lose trick after trick, that the ignorant Mormon elders felt perfect confidence in challenging them. And the explanation, I believe, is that their cards were worthless. They had nothing to put in the place of Smith's presentation. Here's a scientific objection in the first volume of the American Anthropologist. A portentous danger sign, a monstrosity born of deceit and bred of falsehood, a monster of iniquity and deceit. Its precepts and teachings are not in themselves immoral. The Book of Mormon is not an immoral book. It's still this article. There's no polygamy in it. There's nothing immoral in the book. And what's the danger? Its adherents have discovered a most dangerous weapon against the moral world in the doctrine of a continuing revelation. To accept any dispensation formulated in the terms of thus saith the Lord is a portentous danger signal to enlightened civilization. It was something different, and it was shocking. It has been said, article in Putnam's here in 1854, it has been observed for some reason that had a Rabelais or Swift told the story of the Mormons under the veil of allegory, mankind would probably have entered a protest against the extravagance of the satirist. See, the Mormon story itself, from Joseph Smith's first vision on, was part of the scenario and continued to move in ways completely alien to any accepted patterns. So, I'm going to skip a lot of those, get on to this point. Since the days of Joseph Smith, other scenarios have emerged, were not known then. Egyptians, Babylonians, the Hindus, for example, the ancient people everywhere had elaborate cycles of rites with suitableness to explain them, and ordinances of great antiquity pursuing the year cycle, exactly the manner of the Hopis. The only people I know of who still preserve the whole cycle intact this day. What a marvelous performance that is for them. None of this was known in the time of Joseph Smith. The Greeks, through the efforts of the Cambridge scholars, introduced patternism in 1930 to the world. So they're now known to have such a cycle and such a scenario. My own doctoral thesis pointed out the great drama of the Roman year rite has expressed a consistent scenario, just the same sort of thing. They had the same cycle. The idea, which at the time shocked my committee, they never heard of anything so outrageous, which let the thing pass only because they didn't read it. But my purpose tonight is not to explore the scenarios of other times and people, but to discuss the total absence of such in the world today, along with recognition on all fronts that such a scenario is exactly what is desperately needed to give meaning to our life. I'm going to tell you what you already know, in other words, illustrating it from endless, there are endless, of course. Anywhere you turn, you're going to find substantiation to this. But going back to Joseph Smith's time, what we often fail to realize is that the Christian churches at that time had what Alfred North Whitehead calls, by a process of long and undignified retreat, progressively accommodated themselves to the teachings of science from every century and every century from the second century on. So there really was only one scenario in the world at that time. In the following century, Oregon, the first true founder of conventional Christian theology, wrote a work entitled On the First Principles, in which he found himself unable to answer such questions because the church of his day had no specific teachings on the subject, but did have He did have a good deal of information surviving from the teachings of the Brethren of the Primitive Church, which he put forward as suggestions, haltingly, with considerable puzzlement. Because he's still contaminated with such old wives' tales, as St. Jerome calls them, Oregon was never made a saint. His great follower was St. Augustine, who gave up the old scenario only after a long, painful struggle and by a desperate manipulation of rhetoric and logic, committed the Christian world to the Neoplatonic scenario of Alexandria, which he got from Oregon. Ever since, the position of the doctrines has been that questions such as Clements and the Gnostics asked have nothing to do with religion. They say, leave that out. God is everything, and that's it. The beginning and end of the story. Well, to satisfy human hunger for something better than allegories and hairsplittings of Alexandria, the church substituted from the 5th century on a brand of new popular scenario. And this goes into the memes and the plays, the real dramas from the 5th to the 16th century in the Middle Ages that became so very popular, the legends that took the place of the old doctrines. And this is a long citation from Mean on that particular subject. But the point is, he says at the end here, from the 5th to the 16th century, they ruled the soul of the people as well as the imagination of the poet and artist. Then, almost overnight, they disappeared completely with the rise of rationalism and especially the rediscovery of the New Testament. Here was another scenario to compete with this. They were branded as superstitious and puerile. The Bible took their place, but was that enough? Had it ever been? The Reformation did away with the medieval scenario and its liturgical trappings, but what did it put in their place? Nothing. They returned to the Bible, but all they could do was agree on what Catholics already had. There never was a more positive and optimistic and devout Christian than Pascal, and a less prejudiced one. And he shows us where we stand here. He says, a man is nothing but a vessel of error. See, he's always looking for this and not finding it. He's a great scientist, as you know, the inventor of a computer, a phenomenal person. A man is nothing but a vessel of error, natural and ineffable, lacking in grace. Nothing shows him the truth. Everything fools him. Those two foundations of truth, reason and perception, science he called it, deceive him reciprocally. The senses deceive the reason by false appearances, and the trick they play on it, they get back with interest as reason takes its revenge. The emotions trouble the senses and distort the impressions they receive. They lie and deceive at every step. Pascal will deny this world completely, the world we're in now. My heart was full of affection for this world when I enjoyed health. Destroy in me the power of my health, O God, and make me incapable of enjoying anything in this world. O God, who is going to destroy this world and everything that's in it, heaven and earth and all that's in them, are going to do it, he says, to show all men, que rien subsiste que vous, that nothing exists but you. That's the idea of going back to God. This is St. Augustine too. Make me incapable of enjoying the sweetness of health and the pleasures of the world. Make me think of my sickness as a kind of death. And yet he cannot accept that. He says, but I confess, my God, that neither sermons nor books, neither thy sacred scriptures nor thy most holy mysteries, neither alms nor fasting nor mortification nor miracles nor sacraments, goes on and on, can do anything to commence my conversion. I would never dare to appeal to thee if I could find an answer anywhere else. He's looking for this scenario, as you get. He is not the mystic, but the searching soul. He says, and a soul can abandon itself safely to trusting in thee without scruple. Why can you trust God? Not from an emotional surge, he says, but because vous ne serez jamais détruit. You will never be destroyed. You will go on forever, and that's what you want. That's what they're looking for all the time. And he's opuscule. He says, I have wasted the day of my probation by loss, entire loss of the time which you have given me to worship you, to search out in all my efforts the means of pleasing you. Lord, what can I do to oblige you to pour your spirit out upon this miserable earth? Everything in this earth is odious to you. You won't have anything to do with it. Lord, I know only one thing, that it is bon de vous suivre. It's good to follow thee. After that, I don't know what is good or bad in anything. I don't know which is best for me, sickness or health, riches or poverty. I can't decide about anything in this world. It's a discernment that surpasses my strength, the knowledge of men and of angels. It's hidden in thee and in thee alone in thy providence. Notice the point is this, from St. Augustine also. There is a plot, for there is a God, and that's our comfort. But only God knows what the plot is. So all we can do is cling to him. And now, this was the state, we're going to return to this minute. But as a theology student, going out of the scientists, Darwin at the age of 20 felt that the Bible was disturbingly defective. Like everybody else, he attributed insufficiency not to the corruption of the schools, which had made it that way, but to its primitive origin, savages. Incidentally, he says here in his journal, at the age of 20, he says he decided the Old Testament is on an intellectual level, not in any way superior to that of the mumbo-jumbo of the Hindus. So there's another great scenario which he did not understand. He was determined to come up with a better scenario, and the most important contribution of his famous theory was its religious nature. It was immediately and ecstatically received by educated people as at last something to take the place of Genesis. And it brought on an instant clash between its defenders, who stumped the circuits in the best evangelizing manner, and their rivals in the pulpit. The Scopes trial dramatized the meeting of the two, contending for exclusive production rights, and shows how pitifully inadequate both scenarios were. The scientific scenario is most enthusiastically presented as such, a dramatic description that explains absolutely everything. Robert Jastrow, in which he presents it in this terms, concludes his book with this statement from Darwin: "There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, as having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved, having originally been breathed in by the Creator into new forms, or into few forms, or into one." The thing to note here is that the mighty drama is only a drama if it has a spectator to appreciate it, and a creator to produce it. Darwin's successors, however, not only threw out the plot, but teach us we cannot be scientists unless we insist that there is no plot, that all is mechanism, first proposition, the second, that all is without significance, therefore, and thirdly, the situation. Those are the three things. Now, first point, that all is mechanism. Lots of quotations on that, you don't have to look far, but some of them are quite punchy. Coiray, a great scientist, writes, "Newton's force of attraction, which to him was evidence for the working of God, became a purely physical force within his followers, a property of matter that enriched mechanism instead of supplanting it." And in Karl Popperson's even was to supplant purposeful adaption by some mechanism. All is mechanism here. Eddington noted that as soon as the 19th century science, quoting him here, scented a piece of mechanism, it would exclaim, "Here we are getting to bedrock. This is what things should resolve themselves into. This is the ultimate reality." And they kept doing that step by step. The product of this thinking, he says, was the process which Darwin envisaged. The process of evolution of life as a consequence of operation of purely natural forces. And Shapley, the astronomer, who goes around evangelizing and did very recently until his death, the Harvard astronomer, he says, "The origin and growth of organisms has been natural, not in the least supernatural. The primitive lightning played on the primitive rocks, on the gases in the rocks. The ultraviolet sunlight participated in the evolution, and see what happened on planet number 3, for here we are." Now, in modern as in ancient times, the basic philosophy of science was then that all things could be accounted for in purely physical terms, beginning already, see, with the Milesian school and the theory. As Joe had said, everything was to be held ultimately analyzable into matter and the movements of matter. Things just happen. G.G. Simpson, who was a little tin god down at CY in the geology department, or used to be, he's the famous geologist from Harvard. "Evolution is a fully natural process, inherent in the physical properties of the universe by which life arose in the first place and by which all living things have been developed." Well, perfectly tautological. The word inherent hasn't explained anything. It just happens, is all you say. In the same way, the clearest expression of the worldwide view of Darwinism is Tyndall's famous statement in the 1874 meeting of the British Association that science would be able to survey ultimately purely atoms of the primeval nebula to the proceedings of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, from the lowest, the single atom to its final triumph. There. But notice, ultimately, purely natural and inevitable march. This is the mechanistic theory. You don't need to labor it to death, though. But the idea is, there's no scenario, there's no conscious plot. So that Courant and Robbins say in the introduction to their book, What is Mathematics? "For scientific procedure, it is important to discard elements of a metaphysical character, to renounce the goal of knowing the ultimate truth, of unraveling the innermost essence of the world, may be a psychological hardship for naive enthusiasts. But in fact, it was one of the most fruitful turns in modern thinking, and in ancient too, as a matter of fact. But it leads nowhere. And, well, the scientific quoting Joad again, the scientific view of the universe has three main foundations: matter as the only form of reality, mechanical as the only kind of law, evolution as an automatic process. The implications are disastrous for religion, we're still quoting. There is no God, there's not even a purpose, which makes for good at the heart of the universe, for the universe has no heart. There's no world other than the world of things that appear. Religion, then, is a myth, an expression of wish fulfillment. Reichenbach, famous German biologist, says, it is here that Darwin's greatest contribution intervenes. Darwin says that the process of evolution can be explained in terms of causality alone and does not require any teleological conceptions. We can do away with any scenarios we might have. We must in all circumstances learn to accept the facts as Ostwald, the father of modern physiology. We must in all circumstances learn to accept the fact that in the longest run, the sum of all human endeavor has no recognizable significance. We must learn to recognize that, we're told. St. John Dewey. Search for a single inclusive good is doomed to failure. Such happiness as life is capable of comes from the full participation of all our powers in the endeavor to wrest from each changing situation of experience its own full and unique meaning. Carpe diem, you grab the moment, and that's it, because that's all you're ever going to get. Man is the expression, says L.L. White, of universal, organic, social, and personal formative tendencies in a world of accidents. And without any scenario, you have an anti-plot here. Thanks to Darwin, instead of the gracious half-divine figures of the Golden Age, we're quoting Bevan here, we are shown a breed of hairy gorilla-like creatures huddling and gibbering in caves and tearing each other in the blind struggle for life. R. Jordan, who was quite influential in this earlier in the century, says, there is no morality in life, no truth, no goodness, and no beauty. Life in all its adaptability and elasticity is as elemental as iron or sulfur or oxygen or carbon. This is the correct perspective of life. It would indeed save much trouble and avoid many unnecessary errors if philosophers and scientists could look at life in the correct perspective. But there is nothing there. And T.N. George, a famous British writer on evolution, says, in such a rich and varied context of evolutionary lines, it's impossible to discern a single overriding motif in evolution. A scientific explanation of the course of evolution, therefore, avoids reference to either purpose or progress. There is no plot, no form, no beginning and end, in its recognition of the factors of change. So far as it is scientific, it falls back on the empirical evidence. You see, a play, to make any sense at all, you must know the beginning and the end, the protology and the eschatology. If you come in late to the play, you said, what happens? You don't know. You have to say and see how it begins again if you're late for a movie. Or if you have to leave early and don't know how it turns out, you don't know what the play was about. You must have both. The purpose of the gospel, or what this scenario is to give you the play. Otherwise, it's a stage without a play. What are you going to do? It's meaningless. It's this tale told by an idiot. So here we are on the stage, and we have to participate. We're not only interested in this great play that's going on around us, but we have to take a part in it, an intelligent role. And unless I know how it begins or ends, what it's all about, I turn to the person next to me, what's going on? What am I supposed to be doing? He says, I don't know, I just got here myself. And before you even get started, bing, you go away. See, the play's been going on for ages before we get here. It's going to go on after we leave. What can you do while you're here? This is why this plot is all important. This is why the play's the thing. And you don't have it, and where does it leave you? It leaves you dangling. Now here is a continuation of that quotation of Tyndall at the 1874 meeting of the British Association, where he says, ultimately, purely natural and inevitable march of evolution from the atom to the British Association for Advancement of Science. In a universe so conceived, he says, life is of profound unimportance, merely an eddy in primeval slime. There is no play, forget about it. Forget about the source. And Diderot, yeah, the same thing. When I compare men to the immense space which is over their heads and under their feet, I have made them ants that bustle about on an anthill. Their vices and virtues, shrinking in the same proportion, are reduced to nothingness. But then he says an interesting thing. But I like a philosophy which exalts mankind. To degrade it is to encourage men to vice. See, this is the thing that happens. So a wonderful passage there in the Book of Alma, the 30th chapter at the end of the 17th verse, where it says that philosophy, the teaching of Korihor, he gives them his neo-Darwinism and so forth. And it said, and whatsoever man did, therefore, was no sin, for once a man was dead, that was the end thereof. Therefore, he says, people lifted up their heads in sin and rejoiced. They were free to do what they wanted to do. But this is the result, as Diderot sees. The most important advance, the astronomer Shapley again, the most important advance of the 20th century has been the laboratory achievement which shows that there is no need for explaining the origin of life in terms of miraculous or supernatural. Life occurs automatically, everywhere the conditions are right. It will not only occur, but persist and evolve. Notice, he's just arguing in a circle. The key words are automatically and no need, which explains nothing. After all, if you say if the conditions are right, a cow will turn into a freight train. If the conditions are right, you see, you haven't explained a thing, in other words. Well, and they know that and get around to that. The scientist's own career, this is what took its place and got us through for a while. Namely, the scientist's own career is the real scenario. It's very dramatic and spectacular and absorbing, and those that are being very successful and so forth can overlook these things and can preach terror to the rest of us because their careers are doing very nicely, thank you. And the men who pushed this most, like Huxley and Shapley and Simpson and so forth, were terrific publicity hounds. They were after it all the time. And they're fascinated enough to be distracted by their own careers, and it works for a while. They could preach this because their own positions were secure, and their world was comfortable and safe, their secure world, their careers and incomes assured, and the immediate future more flattering than terrifying. They even condescended to supply an element of religious satisfaction to their audiences with a gospel scenario of their own. As Popper notes, all science is cosmology because the scientist, as a scientist, in the first place and last, because he has more than ordinary curiosity. He does want to know what is beyond and will never rest until he does. Isn't it significant, though, that science and philosophy immediately lose their audience the moment they stop talking about religion, either for or against it? Their own white jacket narcissism, H.G. Wells' image of men like gods, gives them cold comfort without an audience. The novels of C.P. Snow, which have been so many, about Cambridge, the scientific community at Cambridge, attest the failure of even the greatest scientists to find fulfillment in their much heralded, humble devotion to truth. They're all working for one thing, its eminence, and the best of them will stop at nothing to get it. Here last week came out in the New York Times, a big story, and it's called, full page, it's called Fraud in Research is a Rising Problem. But they also go back and research the works of great scientists in the past and discover that so much of their work was fraudulent. You do anything to get recognition. It's humble seekers for truth, don't fool yourself. The picture of Mendel here, and it says, the great Mendel, there's not one chance in a thousand that Mendel really performed the experiments he said he did. He faked them. Of course, it was awfully good guessing. But this is all about that, some famous things. Here's a famous Austrian geneticist, Paul Kammer, who committed suicide when they started examining his so-and-so. And the British psychologist whose work on the Negro had just been exploded as being fake research, etc., etc. But here is the attitude there. A writer, this is Edmund R. Leach, an anthropologist, who's the provost of King's College, Cambridge, entitled New Science. Scientists have the right to play God. We'll give you a scenario. Don't look any further. He says, there can be no source for these moral judgments except the scientist himself. Our idea of God is a product of history. He is also a kind of trickster who intervenes in human affairs in quite an arbitrary way. All other living species, whether animals or plants, exist only for our own convenience. We feel free to exploit or destroy them as we think fit. It's true that some sentimental laymen have moral qualms about vivisection, but no orthodox scientist could ever have any hesitation about experiments involving mere animals. It has become useless to appeal to God against the devil. A scientist must be the source of his own morality. All the marvels of creation are seen to be a mechanism rather than mysteries. So we know that. So we must now learn to play God in a moral as well as a creative or destructive sense. We ourselves have to decide what is sin and what is virtue, and we must do so on the basis of our modern knowledge, which is exactly what the schoolmen of the Middle Ages were doing, and the schoolmen of Alexandria were doing, and the sophists were doing, talking about vice and virtue and so forth on the basis of the latest modern knowledge. But we will supply you. And so they start the scientific sermonizing, in which, as Karl Popper says, with Baconian science, God's omnipotence and omniscience were replaced by the omnipotence of nature and by the virtual omniscience of natural science. All that was needed was to approach the goddess nature with a pure mind, free of prejudice, and she would readily yield her secrets. Evolution now becomes, Toulmin says, not only the source of comfort and reassurance, it figures also, see, it's becoming a sort of gospel now, as the imminent and omnipresent creator, whose agent it is man's privilege to be. All the wonders for which Archdeacon Paley were evidences for the existence of God can on this view be put to the credit of evolution, just to substitute one word for another. Science is no longer mechanistic or material. L.H. Frank piously observes, today scientists conceive of a dynamic world in which basic dynamics of atoms and electrical charges within atoms operate to produce events. It's no longer mechanistic or materialistic. It's now composed of atoms and electric charges. That's a very different thing. Was that supposed to be spiritual? I don't know. Whoever knows how to begin the study? We must be prepared for the possibility that the human brain will never be able to understand itself, or consciousness, or perhaps the nature of life itself. If so, there may indeed be a truly impenetrable barrier ahead of us in biology, and the theory of dialectical materialism will be disproved. I have the temerity to speak, it's still Sam talking, about biology in its relation to religion, for they are, in a sense, contiguous subjects after the same thing. Religion being defined as an interpretation, perhaps an emotional interpretation, of those problems of life to which the biological sciences have not yet been able to provide any reasonable answers. This is a very interesting thing, isn't it? Here we have two of them. One is an over-emotional interpretation, so we can't trust that. So we can't trust the traditional religious scenario. And on the other hand, the biological sciences, which he says will come nearest to the answer, have not been able to provide any reasonable answers at all. So they haven't been able to give us the scenario either. What do we do? Well, we can't cop out, he says. Even so, here we are, and we had better find some meaning or invent one for ourselves. In other words, you have to have a play. Remember what the scientist does. He studies the properties of the play. He weighs and measures the things that can be observed and felt. The costumes that paint the settings, the scenery, the lighting, they're his business. But the play is none of his concern, the drama itself. He doesn't say who makes the play or whether it... And so he says there is no play. The main thing is get it through your head. Don't look for that. Things just happen mechanically. Well, he studies the settings, and as he says here, but now we'd better look for some meaning to our play or invent one for ourselves so that we have some definite mission. He used the word mission. Notice a role in the play. Some definite mission to lend dignity to our life. We should have faith that a meaning is at least worth looking for by the usual rational experimental approach. We do not yet know where we came from. Now, this is the play. We do not yet know where we came from, where we are going to, or why we are here, or what life is all about. It behooves us to find out whatever there is that might be defined as God's purpose. We're here in the other play now. Unlike the physical sciences, biology can be almost a religion in itself. See what a confession that is. These are the questions that Clement of Rome started out with and couldn't answer. But it's when we come to the most venerable literary figures that we find the real cries of defiance and despair. This has been part of the literary tradition down through the centuries. Epic literature, for example, expressed very well by Gordon in his very good study on the Old Norse epic. He says, the heroic problem of life lay primarily in the struggle for freedom of will against the pains of the body and fear of death, against fate itself, so the hero resisted to the end and won satisfaction from fate in being master of his life while he had it. Most heroic literature is tragic, and most true tragedy is heroic. The hero is one who will face the tragedy, which is that you are going nowhere. Tragedy is no plot. And then he goes on, a good resistance against heroic odds was made the characteristic situation of heroic literature. This situation had an important place even in religious belief. The gods themselves knew that they would in the end be overwhelmed by evil powers, but they were prepared to resist to the last. Every religious-minded man of the heathen age believed that he existed for the sake of that hopeless cause, that plotless plan. You just go on full of sound and fury, and then somebody gets killed. Macbeth was right. See, he's going nowhere. Then, the favorite of Euripides, of course you could cite Homer as epic. Remember how he starts out? Look, here's what he says of Homer. Homer proves that one thing to us, that life on this earth is a hell. That's what he has to tell us. Well, but the favorite chorus of Euripides, unless does more plays than any degree, he used it in five of his plays. Five of his plays end with the same chorus, which is his great favorite. Polai morphai ton daemonion. The forces of nature, the daemonus, take many forms, he says. Polai the elptus crine epitheoi. Many unexpected things are brought to pass by the gods. Kaito docetentu catelesto. And the things we had always been taught to expect don't come to pass. Todato keto helvum for a film. But God finds a way to bring about the last thing in the world we were looking for. Now he says, try to explain that. Toil the case of Duke de Prague. And that's how this play happens. Don't ask me, he says. There's no answer. There's no plot. That's why there is no plot. It is tragic, truly tragic. That's why Aristotle calls Euripides Tragikotatos, the most tragic of all writers. Because the others, see, Aeschylus and Euripides were still clinging to the old religious traditions there, of which they had fragments and some very powerful ones. But Euripides was the psychologist. He saw through it all. And he received the new light, the sophist, and so forth. So he was the most tragic of all. Going back, the earliest in civilization, the first and the greatest of Greek wise men, the wisest of Greeks, was the great Solon of Athens. And some quotations from him here. No ransom that he can give enables the man to escape death or dire disease or creeping evil of old age. At every turn, the mind of the immortals is hid from men. Till then, it's like death. Until death, like gaping fools, we amuse ourselves with empty dreams. But be sure that neither bird nor sacrificial victim will avert what fate ordains. One man, though he's trying to acquit himself well, falleth unaware into great and dire misfortune. And another, who playeth his part ill, is blessed with good luck by the gods and granted release from his folly. Wretched are they upon all upon whom the sun looks down. This reminds me, just now, Euripides, I was thinking of the Waiting for Godot, the theater of the absurd. That's what Euripides says. When you have no plot ahead of time, when you don't know how it begins and how it ends, when there's no plot laid out, you have the theater of the absurd, which is the best reflection of our world, theater of the absurd of all things. Better write that down so I don't forget it there. But it is the characteristic of our times, you see. And then, these are the people from whom the Romans got what encouragement they have. Their literature reaches its height in the most despairing of all genres of literature. Pure, bitter, honest satire. Perseus, Horace, Juvenal, Martial, Petronius especially, whose grim humor covers the most magnificent commentary on our own age, from which Lucan tears every vestige of pretense to show us the stark horror of people who don't know where they are going. The comforts of the Middle Age and the pleasant legends I've already mentioned and go into them. The great monument and defense of the medieval church to defy the void is scholastic philosophy. Why was it abandoned in our own time, the chief pride and glory up to the World War II? It was even in the Middle Ages not convincing, and what the scholars end up as, of course, is with the Carmen of Burana and Gaudiamus Igitur. That was the philosophy of the school of the Middle Ages, the traveling students of Juvenus num sumus, rejoice while we're young, because post molestum senec tutum, post after jucundum juventutum, after youth and after miserable old age comes what? Nothing, nothing, nothing. No sub habit humus. The dirt's going to happen, that's it. And the classic instance of man without a scenario is Faust. Oh, I forgot the passage, a long opening passage from Marlowe's Faust, from which Goethe got his. Goethe's almost a literal translation of it. Remember, Goethe's Faust, the great Faust, in the opening scene, is the learnedest man in the world. He's the man who knows all the answers. I go, Doktor Gar, and he starts out his opening lines, Habla Ach, Theologie and Philosophy, Durchlung studiert. I've studied every subject in the catalog I've studied, and where has it gotten? He says, I don't know what it's all about. I'm sick of having to spoof people here. Das ist nicht mehr mit saurem Speis zu sagen, brauche ich nicht weiß. But I have to go on saying what I do not really believe with this sour sweat, he says. This is intolerable. This is an insufferable state of things. Das ist deine Welt. Das ist deine Welt. He says, you call that your world? It's worst kind of nicht so lange leben. A dog couldn't live longer. So he's going to commit suicide. But there's one alternative, and that's his pact with the devil.
Mamet nicht der Magier. First I'll try magic, and now he makes his famous pact to the devil, and that's about. So see, here's the man who knows everything, who has all the knowledge of the world, all the education of the Middle Ages, and he says, I really don't know anything at all. I'm stuck here in this den, accursed hole, strengthened of Dinkerhoff, surrounded by all these books, and they haven't taught me a blessed thing. I really don't know what counts.
What I want to do is say, alle Wirklichkeit zusammen und tu nicht mehr mit Worten kramen. I want to see all reality as it is and not just keep juggling words all the time. That's all he's been doing, so suicide of the devil, that's his choice.
Well, the famous denial of any scenario is one we had to learn when we were kids. Well, we didn't. It was popular in high school, of course. The Rubaiyat, of course, that's both medieval, and it's gives us the Muslim picture, too. That inverted mole men call the sky, beneath which crawling coops we live and die. Lift not your eyes to it for help, for it as impotently moves as you and I. You're not going to get any help from up there. Or one moment, verses like this, you know, one moment in annihilation, one moment of the wine of life to taste. The stars are setting and the caravan starts for the dawn of nothing. All make haste. Do what you can while you can because the caravan's going nowhere this year. Or again, some for the pleasures of this world, like this, and some sigh for the prophet's paradise to come. Want their happiness on the other side? They're looking for it. Don't forget the plot. Oh, take the cash and let the credit go. Nor heed the rumble of the distant drum. Noise off there, forget pie in the sky, take what you can get. The same sort of thing. And philosophy here, but you notice here, he doesn't like the theology of the time. He says, O thou who didst with pitfall and with gin beset the way I was to wander in, wilt thou then with predestination round and mesh me and impute my fall to sin? You set traps for me, and when I go into them, you say, how you sin? He said, wilt thou with predestination round? See, the word he uses, husband, uses a lot. That's predestination, that which is set ahead of time, which was predicted before you came here. This is Kismet. But you notice, predestination is the key to St. Augustine's answer when he gave up the old tradition that his mother still clung to and adapted that of the schoolmen and became the prince of them. It was predestinatio ad damnationem and predestinatio ad salvationem. You're predestined to salvation. That's the only explanation you could give. It's predestined to salvation. That's all. But that's a deus ex machina. That's no plot. That's an escape from it. See, in a Greek play or a Roman play, when an author didn't know how to unravel his plot and make sense of it, he had the god lowered from a basket, by a derrick from the top of the stage. And the god came out and he solved all the problems right there because he had infinite power. And this is exactly what the god's predestination does. Never mind, says Irenaeus, Oregon, all we can say is that God does it all, and that accounts for everything. All day. And that's the plot. That's begging off. And so this is not Shakespeare's sonnet. What do they have to say so beautifully so often? Well, after youth comes nothing again. And his last sonnet is, I'm offending you all. So where is the magician? Since let's say Faust gave himself to magic the same way with Prospero. Shakespeare's Prospero. Remember, when the play comes to the end, he says, now our revels now are ended. These are players, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and have melted into air, into thin air. And life, the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all that it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this unsubstantial pageant, faded, leave not a rack behind. Shakespeare says, we're not going anywhere. He's the man that's concerned with the plot of the play all the time. And his soul, this is the very essence of the tragedy. There's nothing here. It's all just imagining. It's a play we've imagined, and now it's past. You go home, and it's all going to pass away. And the earth itself, and leave not a rack behind, not a shred of a cloud. Who are the writers to whom the present age has given the palms? The prizes regularly go to those who pass as honest enough to face reality, because they keep telling us there is no plot and stop looking for it. Oh, the list is endless. You put it down. Matthew Arnold, Thomas Hardy, Mark Twain, what is man, and so forth. Or Joyce, or Brewster, or O'Neill, or Mencken, or Hemingway, or Günter Grass, or Saul Bellow, or Nabokov, or Heinlein, or Robert Condon, or Huxley, always looking for a plot, never finding one. He was desperate at the end of his life. Sartre says for the left exactly what Ayn Rand says for the right, the way to assert yourself. The only justification for living is to assert yourself to the maximum, either in behalf of your fellows, or in behalf of yourself. And youth is incited to revolt, not by the smugness and security of their parents, but by the desperate lack of security, the desperate emptiness, there's nothing there, the insecurity of people clinging to their possessions as all that they have. Our most celebrated writer filled their pages with fierce and even morbid with these tiny details. They're all artists at that. They paint like Dali, with these very accurate, the fly on the window pane, or the fly crawling up the wall, or the paint cracking, or the rain on the window pane, or covering up the relentless emptiness of life with his fixation with these little sordid little details that become sordid because they fill life, horrifying almost to the point of madness when you look at them, beautifully set forth in T.S. Eliot, certainly one of the most learned and of our poets. Here we have J. Alfred Prufrock. The snug security of ultra-refined society. What's the comfort of science it gives us? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling along the floors of silent seas. That's what he sees himself. Or the comforts of civilization, he says, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead us to an overwhelming conclusion. Oh, do not ask, what is it, he says. The conclusion being that there's nothing. You're down a long street. This is going to take you nowhere, lead you like a tedious argument of insidious intent until you find the conclusion which is overwhelming. And please don't ask what it is. And the comfort of the cosmos, the expanding world we live in now. The worlds revolve like ancient women gathering sticks in vacant lots. That's all it amounts to, after all. Or the culture that comes with cultured setting and companionship. Remember, in the room the ladies come and go, speaking of Michelangelo and so forth. But then, at the end of the tea party, he says, I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid. He's not going anywhere. And so, as long as we can elude ourselves with literature and drink and other things, as A. E. Housman tells us, then we can survive, we can stand this world. But, he says, men at times are sober. They think by fits and starts, and when they think, they fasten their hands upon their hearts. Well, the business here is that we do not have a plot today. If you can think of one, that's great. Well, you say, and everywhere you look, it's the same thing. And I hope we do search for one and try to find one. Well, what about Joseph Smith? Well, that isn't our business to describe now. It's the absence of plot we're told to talk about now. But I have an interesting thing here, just this last Saturday review. Oh, this article. There are two on Haley's... that's another interesting one, the same subject. I brought the wrong one along, but... yeah. Well, anyway, there is review by James Baldwin of Haley's book Roots, of course, and then there's an interview with Roots himself. It's in the recent New York Times book review. And it seems that Haley got going in 1964, he said he was visiting the British Museum. And he saw there the Rosetta Stone, and something moved him very strongly inside. That this Egyptian stuff was concerned to him, of great concern to him. And it has dogged him ever since then, and it was connected with genealogy. And then he said when he visited in Washington, Hall of Records in Washington, he wanted to ask for his genealogy, but he was ashamed to, and he was about to leave, he says, and he was going out, he felt a very strong impulse to go back in again. He saw these people all working in their genealogy, he says, why can't I find mine? And he asked for some film strips, and sure enough, he ran right into the Murray family, into which those slaves were intermarrying perforce there. And here he found these two things. Now, I have had high officials in the church tell me that Joseph Smith was a fool to drag all that crazy Egyptian stuff into the picture. And secondly, I've had one of the best historians, church historians in the church, tell me that there's nothing sillier than these people wasting their time on genealogy. The reason I wanted to list that because here it is, I've got it. It was folded too small. Alex Haley, then in 1964, during a trip to London, I came upon the Rosetta Stone in the British Museum. I was fascinated by its role in locking the door into history. Though I didn't know why, I had a vague sense that it had some personal significance for me. Now, Joseph Smith says, if you get into the whole scenario, you're going to be involved with the Egyptians here, and you're going to be involved in genealogy, whether you like it or not. It's just one favor. It's enormous, the structure he's given us. And then he goes on, I visited the National Archives in Washington later that year for no other reason than curiosity about the names of some slaves my grandmother had mentioned, saying they belonged to Massa Murray in the tobacco translator. Too embarrassed to ask about them, I just took a cursory look through the census records. Finding nothing, I decided to leave. But on my way out, as I passed through the main reading room, I was struck by all those people intently scrutinizing old documents. It occurred to me that they were really trying to find out who they were, and I went back to the microfilm, and after hours of searching, finally found entry, Tom Murray Black, with a list of relatives. Awed by that list, tangible evidence of the family narrative I had heard so many times as a child on our front porch. Suddenly feeling a sense of connection with my ancestors, the idea for Roots began to take shape. Then the interview with James Baldwin, says here, well, reviewing his book, he says, the tragedy of the people doomed to think of themselves as white, that's us, lies in their denial of these origins. They become incoherent because they can never stammer from whence they came. They don't have any genealogy. They have no roots at all, so it makes them incoherent. Now, just these aspects are typical and just emerge here. And Professor Parrish at UCLA used to say the trouble with Joseph Smith was he gave all together too much. I mean, just flooded himself too much stuff. Well, that's true. By all standards, he just poured it on. I mean, in that little doctrine, Pearl of Great Price, there are eight apocryphal works. Eight apocryphal works. They're extensive fragments of which supposed to be quoted. None of them were known in the time of Joseph Smith. Fragments, large fragments, of all of them have been found now, and you can compare them. But he would have to include them in. Of course, it's these things that are changing the whole picture now. The world and everybody's trying to move back in that direction, and the things which were in his day regarded as most outrageous, for example, mention of Revelation and so forth, are now being adopted by churches everywhere. But that's another story. We're not going into that. We live in a stage without a play. There is only one play that I know of. If you can find, now there are ancients. There's a good Egyptian play, but this is very, very fragmentary. We don't have it all. This, and there's a good Babylonian, and there's a good Hindu, and so forth. You might get something. Do they give you the whole picture and so forth? The Christian play. Everybody has fragments of it. Say everybody's scenario has something in it. Anyone that survived at all. But which is the best? You try it on for size. You're not obliged to accept anyone, you see, if you want to. Remember what Joseph Smith said, I don't blame anyone for not believing my story, putting in that form of the story. If I hadn't experienced it, I wouldn't believe it myself. That's an important part of the scenario, too. But so much other stuff he's given us in this. And this is a point of departure, see, for asking, well, can you do better? If you know a famous joke from World War I, if you know of a better role, go to it. And the same thing here. If you can do better, by all means, do better. By all means, get any scenario you want. If you've got it, fine, you're welcome to it. And show it to me. Look for them. And they do run together. If it's a good one, it won't clash. They don't clash. It's remarkable how much they are alike. I mean, the study of the particles and so forth, so much cosmology gets in this stuff, and all this idea of other inhabited worlds and influences between them and all this sort of thing, which was regarded not long ago as having no part in religion at all. Everybody's taking that quite seriously today. But all that is part of the scenario too. So, thank you. I don't take any more time.
We want to thank Dr. Nibley for taking the time and making the effort to come up here from Brigham Young University to speak to you tonight. And I want to thank all of you for coming out and listening to him. And we hope you have a safe trip home.